United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today via video conference by Judge Peach and Judge Allen. We're here today to consider the matter of Stephanie L. Watkins versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 20-5612. Counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
Gideon Miller and Eric Dang for appellant Stephanie L. Watkins.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. And Secretary's counsel?
Your Honor, Omar Youssef, and with me at second chair is Sarah Fusina.
Thank you, Mr. Youssef. As you know, each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Mr. Miller, I understand you would like to reserve 5 minutes of your time?
That is correct.
Okay, we will make that happen. And Mr. Miller, you may proceed when you're ready.
Chief Judge Bartley, Judge Peach, Judge Allen, may it please the court. This case presents the court the opportunity to address three, perhaps four, important questions that may have far-reaching implications on the veterans' benefits system. Those being, how does the Supreme Court's decision in Carr v. Saul impact the doctrine of issue exhaustion, and if that doctrine should be invoked in this case? Second, when does a service member enter duty status for the purposes of full-time duty in the armed forces performed by reserves for training purposes, as contemplated by Section 101.22A and its implementing regulation 3.6C1? And finally, how are we to understand authorized travel to and from such duty as contemplated by Section 101.22E, and how does this statute coexist with Section 106D? On Ms. Watkins' behalf, I've done my best to tackle each one of these issues in the briefing, addressing the most salient points while highlighting my respected counterpart's weaknesses. However, for today's argument, I would like to focus on three matters. First, why the court should hear Ms. Watkins' argument concerning the temporal scope of Section 101.22a. Second, why the court should not only find that Klein governs the facts of this case, but why the court should adopt Klein's holding that active duty for training begins at 1 minute past midnight into the VA canon. And finally, even if not on active duty for training under Section 101.22a, why Ms. Watkins was on authorized travel to such duty as contemplated by Section 101.22e. However, should I get to nothing else, the most important takeaway here is that under VA's own regulation 38 CFR Section 3.203, it is the service department that determines if and when one is on active duty, not the VA. Ms. Watkins does not dispute that Carr leaves a window for issue exhaustion in the non-adversarial veterans benefit system. Indeed, she agrees that Carr does not materially change the application of that doctrine at this court. Rather, Carr further refines it so as to ultimately limit invocation of the doctrine to issues that fall within the sphere of routine objections. In his supplemental memorandum, my esteemed colleague contends, without explaining why, that Ms. Watkins' argument concerning the proper interpretation of Section 101.22a falls within that sphere. With all due respect, it does not. However, the truth of the matter is the court need not even address that argument. As explained in cases such as Robinson or Massey, if the board's decision contains error, then invocation of the doctrine is inappropriate. And here, the board's decision does contain error. That is to say, the question of whether Ms. Watkins was...
Mr. Hill, could I stop you just for one point there? So this is an odd sort of, for me, an odd issue exhaustion, quote, issue, because in a way, this case reminds me a little bit of, in the normal civil litigation context, and criminal as well, something a doctrine called invited error. which is sort of when a party makes an argument to a judge that leads the judge down a certain path, then they can't raise that argument about the judge made an error going down that path when they invited him or her to do it. That's basically what the doctrine says. And in this case, it seems to me this entire issue that has been litigated, because the case was before me once before, and I issued a memoranda decision, all is irrelevant based on your Klein argument, right? Because if your Klein argument is successful, that the same rule Klein adopted 1 minute after midnight, then everything that's gone on in this case for a decade is utterly irrelevant, isn't it?
To an extent, I would agree with that, Your Honor. I would but add...
To what extent would you not? Because it seems to me that if you are right, that at 12:01 on June 2nd, 1997, Ms. Watkins was, by operation of law, on active duty for our purposes, then nothing matters that the board talked about the detour, the itinerary. None of that matters because she was on duty at that moment. Is at least that's the way I understood your argument.
You are correct about that. I guess the reason I said to an extent plays more into the applicability of the doctrine of invited error in this case and in the VA system, in the non-adversarial VA system. Because I would say what we have here is that when appellant looked at this case, whichever way you turned it, there was no question that Ms. Watkins was in a period of authorized travel or she was on duty status. But the issue was the meaning of, or the temporal scope of author of active duty for training is not clear under the statutes and it's not clear under the regulation. But when you look at the April 1997 advance order, which is the Service Department finding in this case, what is clear is that she had 1 day authorized to her for travel. So that's how the initial argument came to fruition. And it was the point counterpoint intellectual tug of war of the adversarial process that made appellant need to, you know, look deeper and find Klein ultimately. And I will add, we did look to, you know, the DOD's regulations. Unfortunately, those are somewhat ambiguous as well. And Klein is really the landing point in all of this, in my opinion.
Mr. Miller, can I just go back to one thing you said about the fact that there aren't any Service Department determination of duty records here? So would you be, you said that just a few sentences ago, would you be satisfied with a remand of this matter for, you know, if we gave VA an instruction to obtain a Service Department determination as to the status of the June 1 date?
Your Honor, I think that, with all due respect, I think that may prove futile because the Secretary secured a supplemental RBA in this case, and they were supposed to secure such records, and I don't think it elicited any records that would be relevant. Moreover, I would submit that the April 1997 advance order is the determinative Service Department finding here, and per that advance order, it stated that she would be on active duty for training for a period of 12 days commencing on June 2nd, 1997, notwithstanding the 1 day of authorized travel that was granted to her. And the language employed in that advance order is very important. That advance order tells her that she was not to report not later than 0700. Not later than is an adverb expression that indicates the external furthest reaches of when something can happen. So it indicates that she was, in fact, on active duty, consistent with Klein, at 1 minute past midnight on the day that she was due to report, and simply that she needed to report by 7 a.m. Now, certainly Ms. Watkins didn't report, which wasn't her intention. She had her bipolar disorder manifested, and she wasn't able to. And the military, you know, had the service department, the Naval Reserves, had every authority to discipline her in the way it saw fit for that action. And I think to an extent, it may have disciplined her by discharging her from the Naval Reserves subsequently in December 1997.
Okay, well, one related question then. Your answer seems to suppose that the service department records that are referenced in 3.203 are that we couldn't go and ask the service department now to make a determination as to the status of that day that's in question here. Is that your understanding, that 3.203, when it's talking about a service department determination, it's service department records and determinations, that those are pre-existing when the veteran, by the time the veteran is appealing to VA, they are already in existence. It's not that VA can go and have the service department make a current determination as to status of a particular day.
Exactly. I think that would be extra regulatory, in fact, because VA ultimately gets to decide if she attains veteran status, not the service department. But what VA can do is ask for the service department finding, and they are bound by what that service department finding states.
But they can't ask the service department for a concurrent finding. They're asking for records that are already in existence, not for the service department to make a concurrent determination.
Correct.
Okay.
And then if I could just follow up with the Chief Judge's question, because I think I know the answer from your argument, I just want to make sure. Mm-hmm. And so what you're pointing to here as the service department finding is not actually U.S. versus Klein, the actual judicial decision, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. What we are asking for is that the April 1997 advance order is the service department finding.
Yes,
and it's the conduit.
Yes, that was the question I wanted to ask, is that because at some points in your briefing, it could be read to say you were pointing to the judicial decision. But I think what you're saying is you take the order and the order says what it is, and what your argument, I just want to make sure I understand it. And your argument is Klein tells us when a person is on active duty. So with the holding in Klein, you read the order by looking through that, if you will.
Exactly. Klein is interpretive of the service department finding in this case. To take it a step further, we are asking the court, and we realize that, you know, this may not be applicable to the facts of this case, what it is, but we're asking the court to also adopt Klein's ruling into the VA canon, because it would set a bright line rule essentially that would ease administrative burden, you know. And I'd like to present a hypothetical on that. Imagine if we didn't have this bright line rule that active duty for training begins at 1 minute past midnight. And I would say that that is consistent with how the VA system is set up. For example, when we offset payments for drill pay, the VA doesn't prorate it based on the hour upon which the service member reported. They simply offset an entire day's worth of compensation. So if we didn't have a bright line rule, I think VA may need to look at the hour upon which a service member arrived at their duty station in every single case, which is quite a task, a fact-intensive task. And I think our solution would actually benefit VA in that regard.
Yeah, counsel, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, thank you. So what you're looking for from the service department, the Navy, evidence that Ms. Watkins was on active duty for the period of 1-13 June. Because the paper that authorizes that gives those dates, and therefore she was on active duty.
That is correct. Essentially, our argument is that Ms. Watkins was in a duty status really from June, 1 minute past midnight on June 1st, 1997, through to June 13th, 1997, because we would include the authorized travel day that was granted to her as a period of duty status.
But now, did she report to duty? She was hospitalized during that period. Did she eventually report into Pensacola?
Your Honor, she did eventually perform service later in July 1997 into August 1997.
And would you consider that active duty?
So that is a question I've thought a lot about, Your Honor. And, you know, certainly that goes beyond the scope of this briefing. But I think in that case, there's a couple of questions that, you know, would really frame whether that would be the case or not. The first is that Ms. Watkins was, there are service department findings. And I think that in that situation, consistent with what we see in military law, it would be appropriate to reach out to the service department under section 3.203C, I believe, for verification as to if that period of time constituted service, because there's no question that she wasn't paid any payments. And it does seem like, consistent with the case of Narita, that service was some informal agreement that was reached between Ms. Watkins and her chain of command. And I think we would have been in a much bigger pickle had those been the facts of the case and had her bipolar disorder manifested during that subsequent period of service.
So she wasn't paid for that period.
Not to our knowledge.
Was she credited with any active duty credits, points, something that would reflect that she was on active duty and that eventually when it came time to determine if she had good years or retirement eligibility, did those days from 1 June to 13 June count for that? So she may not have gotten paid, but was she credited with any points? And because the piece of paper said you were on active duty, you're saying that's enough to get her on active duty, regardless of whether she got paid, whether she reported in, whether she was credited with active duty time.
So for the subsequent period of time, Your Honor, the period from July to August, where she did perform service, there's no record of her being accredited any points for that service. But there is a record of her being accredited points and payment as accounting data in the April 1997 advance order. And, you know, there is a quote that I think is very relevant to understanding how duty status is thought about by the military. And it comes from Klein's predecessor case, 29 NJ 83, in which the Air Force Court of Military Review noted that, for clarification, it is noted that duty status does not depend on duty service. There is no relationship between status and duty. However, a reservist must be in status to perform duty. It is status as opposed to duty that determines when pay and other entitlements and benefits accrue. Now, certainly that quote was made in the context of a UCMJ setting, but that quote really touched upon broader principles about being in duty status. And I think that really speaks volumes here, as applied to this case.
Did she at any time notify her unit or her reporting station of her situation during the June 13 period?
The answer to that is yes, but that is based upon conversations I've had with her, and that I think is somewhat what led to her performing service, the discussions that she had with her chain of command at a subsequent time. But there's no record of that in the record of proceedings, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller, the statement that you just made to Judge Peach regarding that period of service, that she wasn't paid during that period, the June 1 or 2 to 13, do you have, it's hard to ask for a record site for something that is a negative, but where are you getting that from? Is that evident from the its absence from other documents in our record?
Yeah. So Your Honor,
can you give me a record site for that?
There's no documentation in the record that she was provided payment for the period of service that she performed from July to August 1997. For the period of June 1997, that she obviously didn't perform service, but under our position, she was in a duty status. I would submit that the April 1997 advance orders accounting data speaks to that. I don't know what that accounting data means per se, but I think that the fact that there was accounting data listed in it indicates that payments were either made or intended to be made.
And that was in the supplemental record. Is that what you're referring to?
That is actually at 250.
Oh, okay.
251 of the record of proceedings. It's the dispositive document, the April 1997 advance order.
The advance order. But you were talking about an accounting record.
Yeah. So
what's in the supplemental record? I thought I saw something like that in the supplemental.
There's payment in the supplemental records, and that doesn't reference that specifically doesn't reference payment to either period in the supplemental record. But there is accounting data listed in the April 1997 advance order as well.
Counselor, could I interrupt?
Yes.
Thank you. Counselor, are you talking about the second page of the order, the April 29th order? The second page at the bottom says accounting data?
That's correct, John.
And you're saying that accounting data is evidence of payment to Ms. Watkins for the time of 1 June to 13 June.
So it's not per se evidence of payment, because we just don't have a clear answer on that fact, Your Honor. I think it indicates that the service department intended to pay her for that period of time, and that therefore she was in a duty status during that period of time.
Or is it really an indication of which source of funds the payment would be made from?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Miller, isn't this, though, I mean, the colloquies that you've been having, which I found quite interesting with Judge Peach and Chief Judge Bartley, I mean, doesn't this go to why the board, I mean, the board could have explored these things and provided some guidance, right? They could have figured out, was she ever paid for either period of service? What was this second time that she went and served as a nurse? Was it like a backroom deal with her chain of command to substitute? Were there other orders issued? Were these first orders ever withdrawn? That's the problem I'm having is, you know, there may be reasons that this case should be remanded, but it seems like although this first issue doesn't look like it, the Klein issue, it's far more factual. Even with a bright line rule, right? Because we just don't know what happened in that first period of time, whether those orders were transposed to later.
Donna, I understand what you're saying, but I think timing is really of the essence here. And Ms. Watkins was already in a duty status under the advance order in this case when her bipolar disorder manifested. She was, per the advance order, she was in a duty status beginning on June 2nd, 1997. And if you include the period of authorized travel, June 1st, 1997. So I think to an extent, well, it would be somewhat irrelevant to find out if she was, if there was a new, advance order issued for the subsequent period of service, because when her bipolar disorder did manifest, she was already in a duty status under the April 1997 advance order.
Counselor, I know this may be touching on the facts, which might mean that, as indicated, a possibility of a remand, but the appellant began to travel from Memphis, and she ended up in Little Rock, Arkansas, kind of in the opposite direction, and that was on the first. And did the bipolar manifestations happen on the 1st of June?
Your Honor, that's not totally clear from the record either. I could answer that question based upon conversations that I've had personally with Ms. Watkins to the best of her recollection. But to the best of her recollection, her bipolar disorder did manifest on June 2nd, 1997, on the morning of June 2nd, 1997.
And was that the day she was also hospitalized?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And was that in Little Rock, or where was that, Pensacola, Little Rock?
She was hospitalized.
Somewhere in between?
She was hospitalized at Charter Hospital in Little Rock.
Okay, and if she was on active duty, as you are arguing, then did the Navy pay for that medical hospitalization?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that. All I can say is that the Army did put her on temporarily not physically qualified pending further review, and the outcome of that determination was never made. But, you know, similar to my answer to Judge Allen's previous question, I would submit that the military, even if it didn't pay her for that hospitalization, because she was hospitalized in a duty status, the military should have paid her for it. And it wouldn't necessarily absolve the Veterans Administration from finding that Ms. Watkins was in a duty status simply because the military, if we go with this hypothetical, in my opinion, incorrectly did not pay her for a hospitalization that occurred when she was in a duty status.
Ms. Marshall, let's add 10 minutes. Thank you.
So can I follow up on Judge Peach's question, Mr. Miller? I just want to understand this because Judge Peach understands this, I think, much better than I do, given her background. But so is your thought that once those orders were issued, right, the June 12-day plus the travel day, okay, those orders, your argument hinges on the fact that using the logic of Klein, which you're asking us to adopt in this system, that 12, all you need to do is basically have a clock and a calendar, 12:01 a.m., June 2nd. Now, could those orders ever go away? In other words, your argument is that's a finding that we can, a quote finding that we can look through using Klein that reaches the result you asked. But what if she just didn't show up at 7 o'clock in the morning the second, which she didn't, but the point being, let's just assume that she didn't get hospitalized and diagnosed. She was supposed to show up at 7 o'clock in the morning on June 2nd. She didn't. And the next day she injured her knee while playing basketball.
Mm-hmm. So Your Honor, so I think those are in a way two questions. First, in answer to the first one, I would say that as soon as 12:01 a.m. hit on, in our position, June 1st, 1997, those orders cannot go away. If they were revoked prior to that date, then yes, I would submit they could go away. As to the latter part of your question, if Ms. Watkins, it was shown that she was willfully disobeying orders, the military would have every authority to discharge her and discharge her dishonorably, had they seen fit to, or, you know, a line of duty determination could have been performed to investigate why it was she did not comply with her orders. And I think control is a big theme, overarching theme in this case. And if you go back to the case of Spencer, the secretary's precedential decision in that case ultimately got overturned. But even in that case, the secretary was trying to make the case that when a service member is under the control of the military, they're in a duty status. And if the Naval Reserves had said at 12:10 a.m. on June 2nd, 1997, Ms. Watkins, we'd like you to fly out to San Diego. We changed our minds. She would have had to do that. And that's why UCMJ jurisdiction, you know, it's hard to conceive that somebody can get in trouble with the military if they're not under the military's control. When I was in school as a schoolboy, I couldn't get in trouble with my teachers if I hadn't attended that school. It just doesn't make logical sense, in my opinion.
Counselor, do we know whether that set of orders issued on the 29th of April, just to follow up on Judge Allen's question, were those orders ever revoked? Were those orders ever amended?
Your Honor, not to my knowledge, and from discussions I've had with Ms. Watkins, the answer would be no.
So how did she get on active duty for the 21st of July? Was that through an amendment to the original orders, or was that another set of orders?
Once more, Your Honor, based on discussions I've had from Ms. Watkins, it was through discussions simply with her chain of command.
Oh, an informal discussion.
That's correct. She does not recall. She does not recall ever receiving a formal advance order or order telling her to come down to Pensacola on those subsequent dates in July.
So it was a agreement between Ms. Watkins, Corman Watkins, and her chain of command that said, well, since you didn't show up because you were hospitalized during the time that you should have been there per the orders, we'll let you perform the duty beginning the 21st of July for the 12 days.
Yes, Your Honor. Her
pay record would have shown that she was, well, what would her pay record have shown?
I wish I knew the answer to that question, Your Honor, because from the way I understand it, Ms. Watkins performed that subsequent service under an informal agreement, and it does not appear that she was ever paid for those dates.
For any dates, including the ones that she was hospitalized?
That is correct.
So she never was paid for anything related to the 29 April orders or her 21 July duty?
As far as I know, there's no record of her being paid for either period of time. The only indication of such happening would be the April 1997 accounting data, but as stated previously, I don't know what that accounting data means. It's just beyond my scope of knowledge.
Okay, thank you.
Well, with the time I have remaining, I'd also like to address the distinction between 101.22e and section 106d. As to the secretary's reliance on section 106d, as explained in Ms. Watkins' briefs, and as conceded by the secretary in OGC Presidential Decision 1291, the purpose of that statute is to supplement section 101.22e and ensure a veteran is entitled to disability benefits for injuries and certain enumerated diseases that occur while no longer actually in a military status, but while still proceeding directly to or from their duty station. Otherwise stated, if a service member is still within the time frame authorized to them by the service department for travel, they remain actually in a duty status under section 101.22e, and section 106d is inapplicable. And I would submit that to hold otherwise would render section 101.22e inoperative and superfluous, void and insignificant. Indeed, Your Honors, the fact that the board fails to make any reference to section 106d or its regulation 3.6e speaks volumes and should serve as an implicit concession that the board found that those provisions were not governing in this case. It would certainly render my esteemed colleague's reliance upon those provisions impermissible post hoc rationalization. Congress clearly stated in 38 U.S.C. section 101.24b that active military, naval, air, or space service includes any period, I repeat, any period of active duty training, which would then, under section 101.22e, also include any period of authorized travel to or from such duty. This tells us that authorized travel is viewed within a designated period of time under 101.22e. You don't need to show that you're actually in route. It shows that it speaks to the temporal scope that Congress intended. Moreover, when Congress first enacted the portal-to-portal principle that's encapsulated by Section 106d into Public Law 881 in 1956, Congress distinguished that active duty for training includes an allotted period of authorized travel, while inactive duty training contains no such allotted period of time. Congress then included the portal-to-portal language, that's now Section 106D, as a subsection to the definition of inactive duty training. The reason Ms. Watkins submits that Congress did this is because it envisioned that Section 106D would most frequently apply in the setting of inactive duty training, where there is no allotted time period for authorized travel, but still provided coverage for the rare instance where a service member is severely injured or dies, especially for the purposes of DIC benefits. When they are going to or returning from more formal duty, such as active duty for training, once they are beyond the allotted time period granted to them by the service department.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Now we're out of time and have been several times through this argument. Judge Allen, do you have further questions for Mr. Miller?
I don't, Chief.
And Judge Peach, do you have any further questions?
Not at this time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Miller. We will hear from you again on rebuttal. And Mr. Youssef, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. The Secretary has two main arguments here. First, the court should invoke the issue of the doctrine of issue exhaustion against some of Appellant's arguments that she raised here for the first time, despite having had the opportunity to raise them before the court previously and on remand before the board. And second, if the court elects to consider the arguments, it should affirm the board's decision because the board properly found that Appellant was not on active duty when her symptoms set in, as she was not on authorized travel at that time. As to the first point, the court should invoke issue exhaustion and decline to consider the first and third arguments that Appellant raised in her initial brief, which were that Klein is binding on the board and that there was a due process violation regarding the orders. Appellant has been represented by the same counsel twice before the board and before the court, yet, Your Honors, they made the tactical decision not to raise these arguments prior. When this case was previously before the court, it remanded the case because the board did not consider whether Appellant was on authorized travel. The court noted that the Secretary may be correct that Appellant wasn't actually en route to her duty station, but that the board failed to address the issue of authorized travel. The court therefore remanded the case for the board to address the issue. And Your Honors, we would submit that the board properly did so here. But before addressing that issue, Your Honors, this is the classic case where the balancing of interests weighs in favor of invoking issue exhaustion and declining to consider the arguments in the first instance, so as to avoid piecemeal litigation. The factors outlined in federal case law, whether the claimant was represented below, whether the claimant had the same representation, and whether the claimant had the opportunity to raise those arguments below, all weigh in favor of declining to consider the arguments. Your Honors, as discussed in the Secretary's supplemental, the Supreme Court's holding in Carr does not materially change the landscape of how issue exhaustion applies in the VA scheme, and that's for two reasons. First, Carr dealt with the Social Security scheme, which is silent on the issue exhaustion doctrine, whereas in contrast, VA's statutes and regulations require the use of the doctrine in certain situations, which means that we do not get to the adversality test that was discussed in Carr. Your Honor, the second reason is that Carr dealt with constitutional concerns, which are not present here. As to the first point, Your Honors, the Federal Circuit has distinguished the situations when an agency has implemented regulations or there are controlling statutes that require issue exhaustion. And it explained that issue exhaustion is required when agency regulations impose such a requirement, such is the case here. Your Honors, In our briefing, we noted that the Federal Circuit has noted that VA requires issue exhaustion in three situations: when there are errors by the regional office, when there are errors by the board, and then at this court, at the level of this court. Your Honor, the Federal Circuit's consideration of the adversality test is critical because Carr was based largely on the holding in Sims that exhaustion is not required in the Social Security scheme because Social Security statutes are silent and because Social Security proceedings are not adversarial. But again, the critical difference here is that because VA statutes and regulations are not silent, they do require exhaustion. So as a result, we don't.
Mr. Yusuf, I just may be missing this, but can you tell me what statute or regulation you're actually talking about?
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize. So the Federal Circuit in Scott noted 38 CFR 20.202, which noted errors by the regional office on appeal. 38 USC 7252.
So let me just stop you. So you're not pointing to something that really talks about issue exhaustion. You're pointing to, and right now I'm just trying to understand, right? I'm not being critical. You're pointing to something that says if you disagree with something in the regional office's rating decision, you have to tell us what you're disagreeing with. Is that basically the type of things that you're pointing to?
So, Your Honor, correct. We're pointing to existing case law on the issue that discussed that.
Right. So the reason I issued the briefing order is there really isn't a statute that says, and if you don't do this, you've waived it, you've exhausted, whatever. Carver Saul is a Social Security case, to be sure. And if you read it with that view in mind, then maybe you can limit it to that, or maybe you could limit it to the constitutional issues that the Social Security Administration had no ability to deal with that appointments clause challenge in that case. But there are other parts of the case that seem to focus entirely on this idea that it's a proclaimant non-adversarial scenario, right? And if you look at those parts, then arguably, it does call into question some of the pre-existing issue exhaustion. Indeed, the language in Scott that we often cite at our court when we do use issue exhaustion refers specifically to the trucking case that the Supreme Court in Carver v. Saul said is the epitome of an adversarial process. So I think Carr is a muddied situation. Let's put it that way.
Yes, Your Honor, and I can certainly understand that. I think I think the key thing for us here, and first, we would not contest that proceedings before the board or the agency are not adversarial. That is certainly a given. I think the distinction, again, is that, and again, we're relying on the language in Scott that explains that you have these controlling statutes and regulations that require the doctrine in the VA scheme. So that's where we're getting our argument from. And because the Supreme Court and Carr continue to emphasize the fact that the Social Security scheme is silent on the doctrine, that is why, Your Honors, we would submit that there's a distinction here and why it wouldn't necessarily apply. Now, we would submit that the existing test for issue exhaustion, the balancing of interest test, continues and maintains. It was not overruled by Carr. And we would admit that it also, by its very nature, Your Honors, is looking to protect the claimant as well, because again, we're balancing and weighing the interests in a given case. So we would submit that that also exists to protect the interests of the claimant while also considering the interests of the government in a given situation. So I guess that's how we would approach that, I guess, the post-Carr environment that we're in now. We would submit that Carr doesn't change that application. Your Honors, in the alternative, if the court elects to consider Appellant's argument, which the government does not concede, It should reject them and affirm the board's decision. As instructed by the court previously, the board properly found that appellant was not on authorized travel at the time that her symptoms set in.
Could I ask you one question about that, which is something we didn't spend a lot of time with on appellant's counsel? So the board puts a lot of emphasis on the word itinerary, right? Because it says that Ms. Watkins didn't seek a change in her itinerary, therefore what she was on was a detour, an unauthorized detour. The problem I'm having is it's hard to see the orders as reflecting in an itinerary in the way I think about it, right? The orders provide an end point. They don't even provide a beginning point, frankly. They're sent to her in Memphis, but if she had started her travel in Washington, D.C., that would have been okay, right? I'm assuming the government's position isn't that she had to start in Memphis, right?
Well, Your Honors, I think we would actually submit that the context of the... So for your latter point specifically, we think that the orders did suggest that she should start from her home address.
So hypothetically, if she had been on vacation in Panama Beach, Florida, in order to comply with the orders, she would have had to go back to Memphis to turn around to go back to Pensacola?
No, Your Honor. So not necessarily. So I would point Your Honor to... So I was going to get into the statutes.
Well, no. I mean, right now, I just... Even under your interpretation that she had to start from Memphis, which I don't know how anybody would ever guess that. But in any event, we know that then under that interpretation, she has to start in Memphis. She has to end in Pensacola. That's clear, right? But how does the board fill in the middle? Right. An itinerary would usually be I'm going to leave today and then I'm going to be in Newark and then I'll go to Chicago and then I'll go to Palm Beach and then I'll fly back to Boston. That's an itinerary. But here you just, even under your interpretation that you have to start in Memphis and we know you have to end in Pensacola. What's the itinerary?
So, Your Honors, in this case, Mrs. Watkins, so let's, Your Honor, in your hypothetical, if she was in a different location and the orders were anticipating she would start from her home address, the orders do instruct her to request any changes to her itinerary or her, I guess, how she wanted to travel. So in that situation, we would submit that that is something that she should probably do. With respect to the itinerary, Your Honor, itself, so 38 USC 106D lists various factors that are to be considered in considering whether, that various factors that the secretary is to consider when assessing whether a claimant is on authorized travel. And itinerary, Your Honor, is included in that. And so specifically, the statute lists the hour on which the individual is scheduled to arrive, the method of travel, the itinerary, the method in which the travel was performed, and the immediate cause of disability or death.
So I've looked at that. What I'm trying to do is we're here to review the board, right? And my problem is the board puts a tremendous amount of weight on the fact that she deviated from her itinerary. I can't tell from the board's decision what it thinks the itinerary was. Was it literally starting in Memphis, drawing a line? Was it, you know, did the itinerary include using a non-interstate road? All the orders tell us, even under your view, is Memphis and Pensacola. And the board then spends a lot of time. You in your brief talk about 3.6E, right? Directly from... That's a much closer issue, but the board never discusses that at all. And so I'm trying to figure out how do we review the fact that the board was right or wrong, that she deviated from her itinerary, when it doesn't tell us what the itinerary was.
Certainly, Your Honor, I can understand where you're coming from. I think, again, we would look to the orders themselves, and we think that the orders, in addition to them being sent to her home address, the fact that they allotted her one travel day, we also think is key here, because that is consistent with what the joint travel regulations allow. So the joint travel...
The board didn't discuss the joint travel regulations at all either, did they?
No, Your Honor, they didn't.
So the board relies on an itinerary, but doesn't tell us what the itinerary is. And you're going to get in, and the appellant got into the joint travel regulations, which are specifically referred to in the order. But the board didn't talk about that at all. So you see what I'm getting at is that, much like I said to your counterpart on the other side, all of the factual stuff about why did she go back and perform a second time? Was she paid? Was she paid twice? Did she get a credit? You know, nobody explored that. And maybe that's because the argument wasn't raised to the board. But here, this argument was raised to the board, and it seems to me the board's analysis of this travel is exceedingly conclusory. And so why wouldn't we have to remand at a minimum for the board to tell us, what do you understand the itinerary to be, and why do you understand the itinerary to be that?
Mr. Yusuf, I want not to pile on, but I have some additional comments here. The orders that you refer to specifically have stamped on them, advance copy, do not travel on these orders. So do we have a copy of the final order here? We don't know. I mean, you said she didn't get a dispensation to go to Little Rock and then go from Little Rock to Pensacola, but I mean, how would we even know? Because do we even have all of her reserve records here?
Your honors, it is unclear. The record is, it's not clear whether there are any missing records, whether there are any additional records. But again, we would trace that back to the initial argument about issue exhaustion, which if there was a duty to assist error, there were multiple opportunities that my colleague had to raise the argument, but they were not. If appellant felt that there were outstanding records or there were service records, as was discussed while he was speaking as well, again, there's no indication that such an argument was made that would have alerted the board that such development was necessary here.
I mean, if I were the board member, I don't know that I would need an argument to know that I don't have the records necessary to make a decision that's grounded in anything other than pure speculation.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I think the board, what the board was looking at here, again, was the fact that Ms. Watkins was traveling off route. Again, and this is what I was getting at with the joint travel regulations.
Well, why was it off route? That's the point. The board might be right. There might be something that allowed it to say the itinerary from Memphis to Pensacola didn't include Little Rock. Now, I wouldn't think that it necessarily would, but if there's nothing else, if Judge Bartley is right, you know, we don't have a second set of orders that are final. Maybe that has some list, or maybe there's a regulation that talks about, you know, trying to stay as the crow flies or something. I don't know. But here, my problem is the board might be right. The board might be wrong, but I just don't know why it thought that itinerary could be judged by just the beginning and the end.
Certainly, Your Honor, I understand. Again, but I think, as we discussed in our briefs, the answer to why the board made that determination, again, would be found in the belief that the statutes indicate that she should be traveling directly to or from her duty station.
And how do you know that the board member in this case had that understanding? I'm not being critical of you. I'm just saying that when you read the board decision, and this is not like the Klein argument, I can understand why the board did not develop the Klein argument, because nobody presented it to them. This argument was absolutely on the table, and indeed was the centerpiece of my remand. Right? And so you filled in a plausible explanation in your brief, but I just don't know why you can say the board thought that.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think so the board does make one reference, I think it's one, Your Honor. It's on page 7 of the board decision where they note 101, 22, and 38 CFR 3. So I do understand that the board's reasons or bases could have been better in how it articulated its understanding of that. But we think that extrapolating that a bit further is essentially, we think that the board was getting at what we explained here. And again, because the board could have been better, but we don't think that that necessarily means that it was erroneous in making its determination or making its explanation of why it found that the veteran was off route. So, Your Honors,
follow up on a couple of questions there.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, if the appellant had begun travel, you're saying the appellant was authorized one day travel to get to her duty station.
Correct.
And you get that from the JTR.
We get that from the statute
regulation.
And the JTR.
Yeah. So if she had lived in Portland, Oregon, and I noticed that on her travel order, she is authorized using a private POV, privately owned vehicle. But if she was authorized to drive from Portland to Pensacola, that would be more than one day, would it?
Conceivably, yes, Your Honor. The JTRs anticipate 400 miles per day. And so the distance between Memphis and Pensacola is 450 miles. So if you add in Little Rock, that's an additional 200 miles. So she was about 200 miles off route, Your Honor.
So if she hadn't had an episode of the bipolar and she went to Little Rock for whatever reason, then from Little Rock, she went to Pensacola and went back home after her AT was finished. Would she have gotten paid for that Little Rock leg, or how would that happen? How would that be?
Your Honor, it's unclear if she was on authorized travel. If she had permission to go to Little Rock, then conceivably she would have been eligible for payment for that.
But you said that they would be one day equals about 400 and some odd miles. So an authorized day of travel would in conjunction with her orders. So if she went to Little Rock, which I think is in the opposite direction and may have added more miles, she would not have gotten paid for that diversion. She would have just gotten, I imagine some kind of mileage or something if you put in for, she said they said she was authorized reimbursement.
Yes, I would anticipate that she probably would have been authorized maybe another half day of travel or however much the department felt was necessary for that.
If she had been authorized that.
Correct.
But she wasn't.
That's correct, Your Honor. She was not authorized and she did not seek permission to go to
her. And absent any episode, she would have just gotten reimbursed from Memphis mileage to Pensacola, even if she took the detour, but that's all she would get reimbursed for.
I believe so, Your Honor. She would only get reimbursed for what she was authorized for, correct?
And we have to, that's what we have to determine what's she authorized to go, which is what Judge Allen is saying. Well, what was the itinerary that she was authorized to be on? And we think you indicated that if she hadn't had an episode, Little Rock would have been authorized in the sense that she may not have gotten paid, but she wouldn't have been penalized for that.
If she had authorization, then yes, Your Honor, she would have been on authorized travel at that point.
Mr. Yusuf, I just have to clarify something. You responded to Judge Peach that she did not receive authorization to go to Little Rock, but whenever in my line of questioning and Judge Allen's line of questioning earlier, you seem to admit that we don't know because we don't have full reserve records for her. As a matter of fact, we don't have her final order for the June period. We just have an advance copy that says don't use this advance copy. So can I just want to kind of like look backwards 3 minutes here to your answer to Judge Peach and have you clarify that. Memphis to Little Rock to Pensacola.
Yes, Your Honor. So just to clarify, my response was essentially based on what we have in the record. There's no evidence that she was authorized, is how I would say it.
But based on your supplemental memo and your inability to provide the records that the court's September 2021 order had requested, you admit that we don't have a full reserve records.
Possibly, Your Honors. There is certainly the possibility that there are other records that can exist, that may exist, I should say. But again, we would go back to the fact, one, that this was not raised previously. And the second thing is that there's no indication that there are records. It's just a possibility that there may be. So we would submit that the board was not in error here in that regard.
Well, I thought there were enclosures that were referenced in the court's order that you weren't able to come up with, and right now we have this, the naval order that you're referring to has stamped on it advanced copy. So that is, I mean, to me, would that be to you an indication that there are records that we don't have? You said you couldn't be sure that there were records missing, but aren't those indications that records are missing?
Your Honor, it's there could be, but we would submit that they're not necessarily dispositive. There's no indication that there are any dispositive records to the central issue here. That's what we would submit. As far as whether she was on authorized travel to or from Little Rock.
Wouldn't a final copy of the orders be pretty important, at least just taking the board's logic, right? The board's decision focuses heavily on the order. The order says you can't rely on this. You know, maybe there isn't another order, but it seems to me that if a document on its face raises a possibility that, you know, the person was traveling, Pensacola appeared to be expecting her. The only document in the record says advance copy, don't rely on it to travel. That seems, if anything is reasonably raised, it seems to me that reasonably raises the ability or the responsibility of the board to get the order.
Your Honor, yes, I can certainly understand that. And if the court deems that is necessarily here or required here, we would understand. I mean, we would respectfully disagree that it's raised, but we would understand and certainly comply with the court's determination in that regard. But again, Your Honor, we would go back to the fact that this was not raised multiple times, despite having been before the board and the court.
Mr. Yusuf, is there not any evidence in her file that she was credited with active duty for that period, including her day of travel? Is there anywhere that says that she was on active duty? She was credited with active duty.
For the initial period that she was to report?
Yes. And maybe for the second period. That seems to be the issue. Was she on active duty? And the counsel is saying the appellant is saying active duty is determined by the service, not VA. So are there service records that say Ms. Watkin, the appellant was on active duty or has got credit for active duty or got some points for that day or got paid that day, something to indicate that she was on active duty, or an amendment that said you're on active duty for this period of time, 21 July to such and such August?
Your Honor, no, there's nothing in the record indicating that she was determined to have been on duty for that period or for the latter period when she eventually did report. It appears that she was discharged in December 1997 from the reserve component, but there are no records indicating that she definitively served for a certain period or that she received pay for a certain period.
But there should be records. I mean, that's what the whole military is about, records and paper and were you here, were you there, what assignments did you have? You know, I mean, the military seems to run on papers, records.
Yes, Your Honor, correct. We would certainly understand that point here.
I see the time is near to ending. Judge Peach, do you have further questions?
No, I don't.
Judge Allen, do you have further questions for Mr. Yusuf?
I just had one question.
Ms. Marshall, let's add 10 minutes, please.
I just wanted to get your reaction, Mr. Yusuf, to the Klein line of argument. Just the notion that, assume with me that Klein stands for the proposition that for purposes of being subject to discipline under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, 1201 on the day of your orders is the magic dividing line. The logic of the position of appellant, I understand to be, if you could be subject to military discipline for selling drugs at 1201 on a day, but if you at 1201 on that day, you hurt yourself, you're not going to be considered to be active duty, but if you do something bad, you are. And as I understand, the position is just the asymmetry there is tough to handle. So if you can give me your best shot about why a different rule should obtain in the VA context than does in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, that'd be great.
Yes, Your Honor. So I would submit make 2 points here. The first is that Klein is different than the facts of this case. So Klein was concerned with the day that the veteran was supposed to report to duty. But here, Your Honor, we're concerned with the day that the veteran was supposed to travel to duty. So Klein does not mean that Ms. Watkins would have been
take that off the table because it's unclear whether this is June 1st or June 2nd here. Let's just assume this all happened on June 2nd in the morning after 1201, right? So the factual difference perhaps between travel and this, just the pure legal rule that what's now the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces adopted was, we just need to know that date that your orders say, and then 1201 a.m., if you do anything after that date, we can discipline you. The VA position seems to be different than that, and I just want to know why, other than a factual difference in calling, right? Just a legal principle.
Sure, Your Honor. So we think that would run contrary to 106D and its listing of the factors. We think that this is a factual determination that should be made, and the Secretary is to consider various factors in determining whether a claimant was on authorized travel, which would potentially equate to duty status for that purpose. Your Honor, you allude.
Yeah, could you do me a favor? And just for a second, don't weave in the concept of authorized travel here. Okay. Just help me with a hypothetical.
Yes, Your
Honor. If at 12:01 on the date somebody says they are to report to Pensacola, under the Colding and Klein, Ms. Watkins could have been subject to discipline under the Uniform Code of Military Justice from 12:01 a.m. on June 2nd, 1997, right?
Correct.
Okay. VA seems to have a different position about when benefits kick in, if you will, right? The ability to get benefits. It seems to not adopt the Klein rule. And that would suggest to me that there is a period of time where which somebody could be said to be under the control of the military for purposes of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, but not sufficiently active to be entitled to a veteran benefit later. And I'm just trying to understand the basis for that, that and which having nothing to do with travel, under my hypothetical.
Yes, General. So we think that we would disagree because it's a fact-intensive inquiry, because otherwise, hypothetically, Your Honor, if we have a situation where a veteran, instead of reporting to duty, goes to takes a trip to the beach, or as you had stated in your hypothetical, they elect to play basketball, if they get injured or if they have an onset of a disease or a condition, just because it's after 12:01, they would be eligible for service-connected benefits. But, Your Honor, we think that that would lead to an absurd result because the claimant wasn't at the reported duty station at the time.
And so so it's just they're in the military for one purpose, but not in the military for another. I don't mean to be flippant, but that has to be the answer, right? Because if they went to the beach and they hurt themselves, your answer would be, they're not in the appropriate status. They can't get a benefit. But if they went to the beach and sold drugs, they could be prosecuted under the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Well, Your Honor, we think that in that respect, Klein is certainly instructive. It's certainly helpful, but we don't think that it's necessarily dispositive here because we have a different set of laws between how the Service Department handles this and how VA has essentially articulated this as a fact-intensive inquiry.
I do have another question, if I might, Chief. The orders do say that she is to report, was it not later than 0700, 7 o'clock in the morning?
Yes, Your Honor, that's okay. Correct.
So is it your opinion argument that she was on active duty beginning at 7 in the morning on the 2nd of June?
Our position would be that duty did not attach because she was never on authorized
job. But yeah, I mean, just in the pure sense, an order says 7 in the morning you're to report to Pensacola. Is that when active duty starts, at 7 in the morning?
Yes.
Okay. And if this individual was at Pensacola, but it was at 6 in the morning instead of 7, and had a injury or a heart attack or fell down the steps getting to the... Would that injury have occurred on active duty? Because it was 6 in the morning, not 7.
Conceivably, Your Honor, this is probably why Klein is helpful, because it would suggest that the veteran's injury would be covered in that instance. But again, we would submit that it's not dispositive.
Thank you.
Mr. Youssef, as to Klein, doesn't it make sense that if the CAF now, or the Court of Military Appeals then, if those decisions are binding on the Service Department and Service Department determinations are binding on VA for all intents and purposes, then a CAF decision would indeed be something that at least would be instructive and that the board should consider, kind of like we do with manual provisions nowadays.
Your Honor, if we had a service department determination, then yes. But because we don't have that here, then I don't think that a judicial determination in that court would necessarily be binding on the board here.
Well, we don't have a determination, do we? I mean, is it in the record? The determination is whether she was credited with active duty or not. I mean, that's my understanding.
That is correct, Your Honor. And I'm sorry if I misspoke. I meant that the court's holding in that court would not be binding on the board. That's what it means.
Well, not binding. That's why I avoided the term binding and just used the term instructive.
It could be instructive, Your Honor. Again, we note that Klein can be instructive here. We just don't think that it's positive.
So if the board, if the service department said, determined that she was credited with active duty for that particular period, June 2 to 13 June, if the service records show that, then is that binding on the VA?
Service department's finding about the nature of her service is binding on
the VA. Not the nature, you know, because it was honorable to some, but the fact that she was on active duty, that determination, that finding that the board, that the service department said, yes, she was on active duty for those days.
Your Honor, would that, I guess the question would be whether that included the authorized travel. And if so, then conceivably, yes.
Yeah. So some evidence of that. I mean, that's kind of, I think, what we're missing here.
Right, Your Honor. We think that that's...
Shouldn't we find out if she was paid for this period? Because if she was paid for this period, that would be pretty close, if not a service department finding that she was on active duty.
Certainly, Your Honor. Yes. We're just saying that we don't have any evidence that she was or was not here.
Do we have any evidence that the board ever looked?
We do not. I don't believe so. We also, as I noted, we don't have any evidence that it was raised either.
Well, Mr. Yusuf,
by the appellant.
Mr. Yusuf, I thought in the supplemental record there was a document that indicated that VA was looking for her records, and the response came back, they've not been retired yet, and look elsewhere, some code, they were, you know, giving a code of a department that VA should further search, and it wasn't clear to me whether that's on page 1552 of the supplemental record. Do you see 1552, the box there at the bottom? The
I do, Your Honor.
Yeah. And so,
yeah, so I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, does that indicate that there was another entity that where VA should have looked for the reserve records here? Because it was asking for complete service medical and administrative records to determine the veterans' dates of active duty for training and drill status to include travel time. And the response was, well, look elsewhere.
Conceivably, Your Honor, we think that this, and I think there were a couple of other records that I had noted in the supplemental, they suggest that the agency made some attempt to retrieve these records. I don't think that it's necessarily indicating that there is something that exists. I don't think that my colleague has indicated that there are any records either to that extent.
Well, but there must be records. I have as little experience in reserve records as anybody here, but there have to be records that show the credits that she got and the pay she got. I mean, there have to be. I mean, maybe they were destroyed or something, but those records have to exist. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, Your Honor, generally, I would agree with that.
Right. And so that's the point, that it seems as if VA seemed to try to get records. They were told not here. It doesn't look like it went anywhere else to do it. And on this issue, this was the dispositive question, whether travel or active duty or leave travel off, even if we ignore Klein, right? It seems to me that there's a gaping hole here.
Yes, Your Honor. And there could be, again, you know, as I had noted, if the court thinks that a remand to obtain those records is necessary here, then, you know, we would understand, even if we respectfully disagree with that, because we don't think that there is error here. I think that the record shows that the agency did make some attempt to retrieve records. And that there was no argument raised about any possible missing records since then.
Judge Peach, do you have any further questions?
I can't imagine that there aren't any records dealing with any service records for this appellant regarding how many days she's been on active duty, how many points does she have this year, or what is there's a fine, it's got to be finance records, as was indicated by Judge Allen, that would reflect, or if they did, that would reflect she's on active duty. But if she was on active duty, but at least a look into the finance records to see if there's any payment made for any duty, because it's clear she did some duty, but the question is when. I mean, that's the crux of the matter, is when did she do this active duty? When was she credited with active duty? How many points did she have? Did she get points for June to 13 June? I mean, it's inconceivable that the Reserve Center or her Naval Unit or the Navy Reserves didn't have something. I mean, we have an order here, but where's the one that doesn't say advance copy? Did she put in for reimbursement for her travel? Maybe she put in reimbursement for her medical care. I don't know. I don't know. It just seems like we're kind of like in this big land of no information.
Judge Peach, Did you have any questions?
Okay. Yes. Sorry about that. Yeah. I guess the question is were there records? What effort was made to obtain those records?
I think
Ms. Marshall, let's add 5 minutes, please.
So yeah, I think there were a couple of attempts to retrieve some records. On pages 1552, 1155, 1158, and then I think there was another request on 1826. So the record shows that there are some attempts to have retrieved these records. And then I think that there's another record, Your Honor, indicating that she wasn't injured while traveling. That's on page 1818. But beyond that, Your Honors, I think we would just maintain that there's been no argument raised about the duty to assist. And that would tie into our issue exhaustion. And we recognize that the issue can be raised by the record, certainly with the duty being on the agency. I guess if the court were to remand for that basis, I think, you know, again, although we would submit that there's no error, we would certainly understand based on the court's concerns that were raised here.
And again, if there are no records, there are no records. I mean, it is what it is then, but I'm having said already what I said.
Judge Allen, do you have any further questions?
Just wanted to make sure that I understand this. You said, so VA has no desire to try to resolve this issue by agreement. I mean, given the discussion that we had here, you know, once the chief judge says at the end of the argument that the matter is submitted, the judicial opinion writing wheels begin. And who knows, maybe we don't say anything about Klein. Maybe we say something about Klein. And so given the lack of records, I just want to be clear. If VA's position is what you said, which is we respectfully disagree, we'll follow the decision, then fine. But if this has caused the agency to think any differently about some of the holes here, I wanted to give you a chance.
Sure, Your Honor. So I guess without revealing too much, out of respect for my colleague, we have tried to come to an agreement here. I think the case was stayed previously as we tried to work to an agreement. But unfortunately, we weren't able to arrive at that agreement. I guess we had disagreements. And so I think that my colleague here today said that his client said that there are no records and that he just wants to rely on the travel orders. So it's not clear to us whether we'd be able to reach an agreement on a duty to assist issue at this stage. But again, we have tried previously.
Thank you, Mr. Youssef.
Thank you. Thank you, Honors.
Thank you. And Mr. Miller, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Regarding the matter of issue preclusion, I would just note that the regulation and my esteemed colleague's reliance upon Scott speaks to whether the issue is raised, not whether a specific argument is raised. It speaks to whether the broader issue, you know, if you don't appeal a rating decision for a service connection for an ankle disorder, you can't then later claim that that's still on appeal. And moreover, I would submit that my esteemed colleague has still not explained how Ms. Watkins' argument concerning the proper interpretation of Section 101.22a falls within the sphere of routine objections. I, for one, am still missing that point. With the rest of my rebuttal, I'd like to try and assuage some of your concerns regarding these factual findings. First and foremost, I would note that the board has accepted the April 1997 advance order. There's no indication that they have said this is invalid, despite the fact that it does say advance copy do not travel on these orders. And throughout the record, Ms. Watkins has, consistent with that, stated that she was due to report at her duty station on June 2nd, 1997, but never made it there because her bipolar disorder manifested on that day. With respect to Ms. Watkins being in Little Rock on June 2nd, 1997, I believe Judge Peach asked the question on this point. The joint travel regulations actually do provide a provision permitting circuitous travel. And the only thing that travel regulation states is that the service member will not be reimbursed for the circuitous travel. Not that it's not authorized. The fact that they have a provision allowing for circuitous travel tells us that it is within the authority that the service department views travel in terms of designated periods of time, and they simply state that if you decide that you want to travel through Little Rock to either drop your children off at your mother's house or visit your children who you may not have seen for 2 weeks, it's okay, but we're just not going to reimburse you for that. And I would submit that we shouldn't necessarily think of duty status as payments. Certainly, you know, being paid for duty is certainly dispositive evidence that one was in a duty status. But so is the April 1997 advance order. In U.S. versus Morita, the Court of Appeals for the Air Force stated that we agree that a form called the AF Form 49 establishes the dates of appellee's active duty service, irrespective of any informal arrangement made to permit him to work on other days for which he was not compensated and to which the AF Form 49s did not refer. Every indication we have from this April 1997 advance order was that, which has been accepted by the board, is that Ms. Watkins and the service department intended for her to be on active duty as of that date in time. You know, we acknowledge that it does say do not travel on these orders, but there's no indication that this order was revoked. Every indication in the record shows that Ms. Watkins intended to be at her duty station on June 2nd, 1997. And under the construct of the facts of this case, the board has accepted this document as a service department finding, and therefore it should prove dispositive. The last thing I'd like to focus on with the 30 seconds I have left is that my esteemed colleague tries to frame this argument in terms of the secretary being able to decide what is and what is not authorized travel. While that is true if 106D were the applicable statute, 106D is not the applicable statute here. If you go back to the congressional history and you look at the way that 106D came into formation, it speaks to that. And I touched upon that at the end of my prior argument, and I see that I'm running out of time, so I'll stop there. But in short, 10122E is the dispositive statute here. And that gives a designated period of time of authorized travel that is set by the military for active duty for training.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Oh, Judge Peach, yes. Do you have a question?
Okay. I have a follow-up question. Thank you very much.
Marshall, would you add to 3 minutes, please?
So, Counselor, just to recap your argument, it is that she had orders, which now you've indicated that the board has accepted that, quote, advanced order as the orders, that she has orders to be on active duty from the 2nd of June to the 13th of June, and therefore she was on active duty.
That's correct, except I would caveat that by saying she also had active duty for the one period, for the 1 day of authorized travel as well.
Okay, but now if she was still in Memphis on the 2nd of June, would she be on active duty?
Yes, she would, Your Honor.
Okay, but what about the fact that this says you are to proceed and report directly to Pensacola?
That's correct, Your Honor, but there's no time given at which time Ms. Watkins needed to leave.
Well, let's say she was still in Memphis on the 2nd. She didn't even, or anybody was on, if they're not at their duty station on the time that the orders say, well, does that make them on active duty? So if she was in Memphis on the 2nd, was she on active duty?
She would be, Your Honor. And the military would have every, authority to punish her for that infraction if she was willfully disobeying an order. That wouldn't show that she was not in a duty status. And it's similar to an individual who may go AWOL. An individual who may go AWOL may still be entitled to a disability that might arise during that period of AWOL if it's determined that the AWOL was not willful misconduct.
But the issue here isn't whether she's entitled to disability. Isn't the issue whether what her status is? was she on active duty or not? And then those other issues come later, depending on the answer.
That is correct. So to rephrase, it wouldn't necessarily matter if the individual was in a different place and not performing service. The secretary has long grappled with the notion that a service member can remain on active duty or in a duty status when not performing service. That's reflected in cases such as Stover and Spencer. And I would submit that my respected counterpart's argument here works its way backward from that flawed logic. You know, an individual simply, duty status is not the same as performing service. The two are not linked hand in hand. Duty status is about how you hold yourself out. It's about being under military control. And when you canvass the military laws, that becomes more and more apparent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller, and thank you, Mr. Youssef. The case is submitted for consideration.
And the court is in recess.